So next up, we have Kyle from Hamilton Health Sciences, and he'll be talking about physical activity for people living with chronic pain. And again, just make sure your cell phones are off. You guys did a great job for the first talk. So I'll give it away to Kyle.
Is this thing on? Yes, you can hear me? Good, okay. So, again, my name is Kyle Vader. I'm a physiotherapist. I actually work at Kingston Health Sciences Center. Close enough, it's a health sciences center. Anyway, so I'm here from Kingston. Today we're gonna be talking about physical activity, but in the context of chronic pain. So we know that physical activity is good, and where my interest comes in is we know physical activity is good, we know it's good for people to do, we know it's hard for people with chronic pain to participate in physical activity. So as healthcare providers, how can we better support people in engaging in physical activity? So today I'm gonna talk about what are some of the common theoretical frameworks underlying behavior change, and I'm also gonna give a couple really quick, simple strategies that hopefully people can leave here today and feel pretty comfortable that you could use these strategies when you're working with people on a day-to-day basis. Okay. So again, a couple objectives for my talk today. I also like to walk around a lot, so if I'm getting too like distracting, just like be like, stay in one spot. So by the end of this session, what I want all of you to understand is that there's different barriers and facilitators to engagement in physical activity for people who are living with chronic pain. But also understand what are some of those common theoretical frameworks. Because I think if we can understand the theory a bit better, it gives us really good reasoning as to why we're doing what we're doing. And even if it gets hard and if it's challenging, we feel pretty confident that we're doing things in line with what makes sense based on research and evidence. And then finally, last piece as a clinical kind of pearl and take home, what are some evidence-informed strategies that all of you can incorporate into your daily practice when you're working with people living with chronic pain? So I specifically work in a chronic pain program at Kingston Health Sciences Center. I'm really lucky that I work as part of an interdisciplinary team where I'm supported by physicians, psychologists, nurse practitioners, social workers, occupational therapists. We have a whole team that I get to work with, so I'm really lucky. And although I work specifically in a chronic pain program, no matter where you're working, you're interacting with people who are living with chronic pain. My focus is specifically in chronic pain, but whether you're working in private practice, in an inpatient setting, in home care, community care, wherever that is, you're interacting with people who are living with persistent and chronic pain. So the more that we can use really informed and evidence-based approaches to helping people staying active, I think that's such a huge role that we can really own and take leadership in. I had a couple other notes of what I wanted to say before. So I'm all about Twitter. On the first page, it had my Twitter handle, which I'll put back up, so you should all be using your phones. This is a time when you can use phones. I want that. So at @Vader_Kyle, you can tweet me. I'll try and tweet back, just to keep it light and fun. Okay, so to start off with, I was really lucky that about 2 years ago when I first started my position at the Chronic Pain Clinic in Kingston, I went to a talk. And it was by Neil Pasricha, who's the author of The Happiness Equation, and his previous book was The Book of Awesome. Kind of like, what are all these awesome things that you can do day to day? What does that look like? And how can that bring people joy? I then went and heard a talk. It was being put on by one of our kind of hospital foundations in Kingston to fundraise money. And at that talk, he was talking about happiness. And amongst those, there were a few different secrets. One of those, as I'm going to highlight, which I think relates to my talk today, is around his third secret, which was talking about behavior and behavior change. And what he talked about is that a lot of us think that if we just wait until I really want to do something, then I'm gonna do it. Like, as soon as I actually really wanna do that, when I wanna start going to hot yoga, when I wanna go for a walk at lunch, when I really wanna do those things, then I'll do it. Sometimes we have those thoughts. What we realized is that's actually not that true. And he quoted, you know, the Nike slogan is so great, just do it. The idea that if we can just start by doing something, so whatever that is, in the context of chronic pain, whether it's you advocating for the person that you're working with to get out and start walking, once they realize that they can actually do it, like, I can get out, I can do a walk, I can get active, even if it's starting small, but it's still something that I can do. And once they realize that they can do it, then that's where we can actually start to develop that motivation of like, you know what, that felt really great, I feel accomplished, I actually feel like I can keep participating in this. So the idea of just do it first, you'll realize you can do it, and then you actually start wanting to do it. And what's neat is, although this is in a more simple version, a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about is actually kind of rooted in this, which is kind of neat. I often use this with lots of the patients that I'm working with because I find it can be a more simplified version of some of the more complex behavior change theories that I'm going to talk about today. So I won't go over these too much because we just had a great presentation by Sarah and Bonnie, which talked about this. But everything that I'm talking about today is in the context of chronic pain because that's where my experience lies. Just as a bit of a story as to how I got into this work, because sometimes when I say, oh, I work in a chronic pain program, and people go, why? They're like unsure why I would have an interest in that. They're like, that's gotta be really hard. And I say, yeah, it is hard, but it's really great and also really rewarding. I think there's a lot of opportunity, specifically as a physiotherapist and other rehab providers. We're about function, we're about participation, we're about improving people's ability to do what they want to do. And pain can take a lot of that stuff away. So I think we're really, really nicely positioned where we can do a lot of those things and make really, really big impacts on people's lives, but also in ways that are safe, effective, and actually really evidence-based. So those are all things we should feel really confident about. So I'm talking about physical activity and exercise, but important to recognize what are the differences. So we know physical activity, by definition, it's kind of any bodily movement, whereas exercise, it's more regimented, it's prescriptive, and it usually has the goal of improving or maintaining physical fitness. So a little bit of a clinical scenario. Can people see this at the back, or should I read it out? I'm gonna read it out. Okay, so David is a 32-year-old male who presents to you in an outpatient chronic pain program at the hospital. So he describes that he's got a 10-year history of disabling low back pain. 5 years ago, he had a spinal fusion surgery that did decrease the intensity of his radiating leg pain, although the intensity of his low back pain has stayed pretty constant. The orthopedic surgeon who did the surgery says that the surgery went as planned and that David is safe to get back to activity. David previously worked as a chef in a kitchen, but he's been off work due to pain for about a year now. He describes that he rarely moves his back and he's having a lot of trouble sleeping due to pain. He avoids most physical activity as he is afraid he may throw out his back. He was previously quite active. He enjoyed walking, playing hockey, although over the past 10 years, he's become less and less active. So he says he's tried to get more active in the past, but each time kind of it fizzles off, loses motivation. I can relate to him on that. I just started hot yoga. I was doing really, really great. Now I've kind of teetered off, but I will get back on the horse. I will do it. So he feels embarrassed about his body and finds that he's spending most of his time thinking about his back pain. He also let me know that he'd gained about 50 pounds in the past year and he's been having trouble with intimacy due to his pain. And he finds that he's getting anxious and self-conscious being around other people. He did tell me that he was interested in getting more active, but he isn't sure how he can even do that now. And he says that no matter what movement he does, it always makes his pain worse. So I've got a question. Based on that, what are some of the barriers and facilitators to physical activity that David might experience? I want you just to chat with your neighbor for about 30 seconds. Based on this story, what's one barrier, what's one facilitator? And then I'm gonna ask for a couple brave volunteers and I will share that up here afterward. Okay, 30 seconds, go. Thank you. Okay, so if we come back together and we'll have a quick conversation as to if we look at his situation, David here, so I've changed the names and changed the scenario a bit, but this is like a very typical situation of someone that I'd see. I think some of the unique things were about this. I don't always work with younger individuals. He was a 32-year-old. He was pretty freaked out about what the future was going to hold for him. I'm a young guy. I've got a girlfriend. I don't know how I'm going to like support this situation. Lots of complexity there. If I can have a couple of brave volunteers, what are a couple barriers to physical activity for David? Anyone to shout it out?
Weight gain.
Sorry.
Weight gain.
Weight gain.
Fear.
Fear. Yes. What else?
Trouble sleeping.
Trouble sleeping. Yeah. Good. Maybe I can get one more.
Belief system.
Belief system. Great. Really good. A couple really great barriers here. Weight gain, fear, trouble sleeping, his overall belief systems. Can we pick out any facilitators for David? What are some things that might make it easier for him to get active?
He's been active before.
So he's been active in the past. Great point. Active before.
He's interested in becoming active again.
Interested in becoming active again. Great.
Girlfriend.
Okay. We'll leave it there. What else? He's young. Great. Okay. Really, really good. So what I like is that I think as physiotherapists and other rehab providers and physiotherapy assistants who may be here, I think we're really good at firstly just helping people realize like what are some of those barriers for you. And what I've actually realized, one of the most valuable things that I can do in my practice day to day is sometimes that first conversation, not worrying as much about what I'm going to do, but understanding why we want to do it, how we can do it, what's gonna get in the way, and what's gonna make it easier. I think I always felt a lot of pressure when I was first started working of like, oh my God, I've gotta get to the physiotherapy, whatever that means. And what I'm learning more and more is that not only can we have a role in what's traditionally looked at as physical activity and exercise, but helping people to feel as though they can engage in physical activity that's meaningful, but also is gonna make them feel more confident. So really good work. So I wanted to talk a bit about a qualitative study that I'm working on right now to give you guys a quick snapshot of some of our preliminary results. So we're specifically conducting interviews with people who are living with chronic pain. They've had pain for at least 3 months. And we're specifically looking at what are the barriers, what are their facilitators, and what are strategies that we can use to better promote engagement, but also long-term participation in physical activity. So I conducted 16 interviews. The median age of our participants was 53. In terms of gender distribution, we had 11 women and 5 men. In terms of the median number of years that people had been living with pain, they've been living with pain for 11 years. The median self-reported level of physical activity, because I wanted to get a sense in our demographics, how active are the people that I'm speaking with? So what we found as the median is that out of 7 days, they were active 2.5 days per week. And on those days, people were engaging in about 30 minutes of what they self-identified as moderate to vigorous physical activity. Again, we weren't using accelerometers or anything quite specific. It was more what was their perceptions, because that's what I wanted to get a sense of. A couple different things that came up here in terms of some of the initial themes, so barriers. Pain itself was a barrier. A risk of flaring up was a barrier. Physical limitations, but also what almost every single person spoke with me about was the idea of their mental health status. So one person said, you know, right now it's probably my anxiety and my depression. That's the worst thing right now. And I think that was really neat because in our training, I wasn't necessarily taught a lot about mental health, depression, how that influences what I'm gonna do with people. But I would say sometimes it really has to come down to, you know, being there with someone, working with them, listening to them, supporting them, making them feel confident. And a lot of those things I didn't have a lot of formal training in. So I'm really, really lucky that I work amongst a team where I'm able to lean on them a lot and they can teach me lots of really great things. In terms of facilitators, people brought up some neat things. Again, these are just some of our preliminary codes. We're still working on doing our formal analysis. But people talked about how, you know, being active can improve other health conditions. Group activities were better than doing it alone. I don't want to do this alone. It's not that exciting for me to sit and do knee extensions alone at home. Not what I want to do right now. Some people, yes, that worked for them. Also, positive self-talk was really, really important. And a neat point that I've kind of seen a lot coming up in our initial transcripts was the idea of working with the pain versus working against it. Because I would say almost every time I work with someone, they go, haha, you know, no pain, no gain, right? People have this ingrained sense that almost things have to get worse and pain has to get worse to get better. And I think there's an element of that that's true, but there's also a bit of maybe restructuring and thinking around what pain is normal to feel when you're living with persistent pain. Woo. So if we think of behavior change, really what we're talking about here is we want to describe how, but also why behavior change occurs. And what I always like to even tell people, if someone's really fearful of movement or not moving a lot, I'll say, you know what, physical activity is a spectrum. Oftentimes we think about a structured and rigorous physical activity is what we really want people doing, but recognizing that physical activity, it's a spectrum, it's a continuum. It's about getting people active in a way that's meaningful for them. So there's a couple different models that I want to go over today. And again, my slides are up there, so if I miss a couple things, you can look there. I want to just hit a couple of the key take-home points. So the health belief model. So it says that a person's beliefs about whether they are susceptible to a disease, but also their perceptions of the benefits of trying to avoid that disease. Both of those influence their likelihood to engage in a health-promoting behavior. So what does that mean for physical activity? So there's a couple things here. We have perceived susceptibility. So in the context of physical activity, that might mean someone's beliefs about the chance of disability or ongoing pain if they don't engage in physical activity. We've also got the perceived severity. So that's talking about people's beliefs about the consequences or what their life might be like as a result of pain or with pain as a result of being inactive. As we were exploring in the study that I'm working on right now, looking at what are those benefits and also what are the barriers. So if we think of perceived benefits, the belief about the effectiveness of exercise to reduce disability and pain, but also the barriers. What are their beliefs about the direct and indirect consequences of exercise? We also know, as you'll see in a couple of the other theories, that self-efficacy comes up a lot. So I think, as I really like what Bonnie was talking about, the idea of getting people to do safe physical activity that's effective, that leads to early success, is going to be helpful in terms of building people's self-efficacy. But also cues to action. And I think this is where sometimes as a healthcare provider, we can come in and be a really important piece for some people. There's also something called social cognitive theory. And it talks about how behavior change is about an interaction between the individual. What are the individual factors about them? What's the behavior? But also, how does the environment impact that? And again, self-efficacy is thought to have a really, really important piece here. But importantly, these all work together. So if we think of individual factors, maybe the behavior and the environment, if my behavior is physical activity and I start going to a hot yoga class, maybe my environment, I'm going to change that a bit. I'm going to go and buy a yoga mat. I'm going to get a towel because I sweat a lot during the yoga class. It's very hot. And individual factors, my own motivation. I've also realized that going to hot yoga with our psychologist helps me to get there. So, you know, environment and social support to physically get me there is important. What I think is really neat about social cognitive theory is it talks about self-efficacy in a different way than I had thought of before. So it talks about task self-efficacy, which is the belief that the individual can physically do that behavior. But there's also barrier self-efficacy, which is the belief that an individual can engage in a behavior despite the barriers that might come up. So it's not only about knowing how to do the task, but it's about feeling as though, okay, even if stuff comes up, I can work through this. There's also the trans-theoretical model, which is talked about quite often. And again, it talks about kind of a series of changes and stages of change, ranging from pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and maintenance. I'm going to talk about it more on the next slide, but the key points are that it talks about there's various processes involved. It's about decisional balance, like where are people at and do they want to get more active? But also, again, self-efficacy, extremely important. So if we look at this circle that I put together here, although I put this in a fairly, as much as I could, neat and tidy way, the reality is this is not as straightforward. People can bounce around. People can be in different stages. People can be previously active, but barriers come up and it can make it harder to be right now. But where it typically starts would be at the pre-contemplation stage. There's one specific study by Marcus and Sinkin that specifically tied these different areas into physical activity. So meaning at the pre-contemplation stage, someone might say, I currently do not exercise and I don't intend to start exercising in the next 6 months. Whereas all the way down to maintenance could be, I currently exercise regularly and I've done so for longer than 6 months. So there's kind of a big range of different stages that people might be at in terms of behavior. So there's a few points missing here, but on the slide there should actually be 14 boxes because there's something that I found really helpful, and it's a behavior change framework called the Theoretical Domains Framework. And it essentially took all of that behavior change research and integrated it into one model. So if you're going to look at one thing for behavior change, the Theoretical Domains Framework is really good for this. So you'll see here on this picture, this is from the paper itself, but there's 14 different domains that they talk about. And you'll find that a lot of them are encompassed in some of the other theories that I've already spoke about, but it's about self-efficacy, confidence, motivation, beliefs, all of that plays a role. So now if we think about, we've got the trans-theoretical model, we've got the health beliefs model, and we've also got social cognitive theory. Based on knowing those, how can we kind of facilitate engagement in physical activity? If we know what are those underlying theoretical frameworks, how can we try and encourage behavior change? But first, I read a book, and it was by these two gentlemen. I can't say the first name, but Ann Turk. And it really helped me a lot in my work in the context of chronic pain. I think a lot of the time I felt, am I not a good provider because I can't get this person engaging in physical activity? They're not showing up for my physical activity sessions, but they're coming in for the injections. Yikes, I'm doing something really wrong. But this book kind of helped to give me some own self-compassion toward myself. But it also talked about the difference between compliance and adherence. And I think a lot of times we hear the word, you know, they're a non-complier, they aren't compliant with their program. And that's not as helpful. It usually refers to the extent to which patients, it's about obedience and following instructions, prescriptions, I should say, provided by healthcare providers. But in contrast, adherence is different. So it talks about the idea that it's an active process. It's a voluntary, collaborative involvement between the healthcare provider and the person living with pain. And it's about kind of trying to work toward that therapeutic result. It's an active process. It's about working together. I found that really helpful. So again, if we think about the qualitative study that I was talking about, the preliminary results, what were people saying are some of the strategies to get people active? What I thought was so interesting is that no one told me I want to make sure that the person knows exactly how to activate my core muscles if I have back pain. Or I want to know exactly how they can activate the VMO muscle of my quads when I have knee pain. No one said these things. What people said, first off, I want you to listen. Do you hear me? Did what I say make sense to you? And do you have my best interest at heart? People said, be encouraging. You know, just the idea that us as a healthcare provider, we can be there to cheer someone on. I often say that my job is really unique and I get to do lots of different things, but I'm kind of like a part-time cheerleader for these people. How can I encourage you? How can I keep you going? Even at the times when it seems hard. Also the way that a coach sometimes has to play the really supportive role sometimes, but sometimes you've got to give a bit of tough love. And to know when to do that really comes down to therapeutic alliance. But people did talk about the idea of, you know what, I really have to start low, I have to go slow. If I do too much off the bat, it's not going to be good, and I'm probably not going to continue with it. So really interesting. I think communication is really what it comes down to. So I'm really just going to introduce these concepts because in the last couple minutes I have here, I really cannot talk about motivational interviewing and do its justice in these couple minutes here. Motivational interviewing, really, really helpful, specifically in the context of pain. If you haven't heard of it, I'd advise you to check it out, whether you watch some videos online or even just understand how can you maybe approach your clinical conversations in a way that's supportive and trying to get people activated, not based on what you want them to do, but what's internally and intrinsically within them that they want to do. If you look at my slides, you'll see there's a couple different processes here. But what I find is most helpful, sometimes when I'm in the midst of a really challenging clinical encounter where I'm going, how the heck did I get here and how do I get out of this? I'll sometimes remind myself of, you know, am I asking open-ended questions? Am I affirming what they're saying? Am I using reflective listening? Am I summarizing? But also, what's my role on informing and advising? And am I doing too much of that and I need to back off? Physical activity counseling, there's something called the 5 A's model. First, an additional one is ask permission. Do people want to talk about physical activity? Is it an interest to them? Do they care about it? And then if they do, you assess, advise, agree, assist, and arrange a specific plan. I find this helpful. Also, goal setting. It's best if it's negotiated, individualized, and self-determined based on the individual, not what I think is best for them, but what they want to get back to. I think that was an important shift for me. What I find is helpful specifically around physical activity, I'll ask people, how achievable do you feel this goal is? Because if I think something's achievable, it may not be for them. But also, how important is this to you? And even if what we're working on right now isn't that meaningful in terms of doing sit to stands to get stronger may not be what someone came in saying they wanted to do. However, that will lead to meaningful change down the road, and how can we keep that in our sights? As was already spoken about by Bonnie, self-monitoring, really important. People want to see success. Logging your progress, it can seem frustrating at first, but really good. And what we want to do is initially focus on just the fact that people are monitoring their activity versus you've actually started doing it. Effort should be rewarded versus the end product of getting more active. So in summary, there's lots of different theoretical frameworks out there. If you want to look at the one that kind of says what everything is that's out there in the literature, the theoretical domains framework is really good for that. There's lots of different strategies out there. Figure out what's best for your patient. But also think of adherence versus compliance and maybe challenge your thinking on that. My last point. Moving forward, how can each of you better support your patients living with chronic pain in an active, non-judgmental, and supportive way to increase their levels of physical activity? And with that, we are done.